Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
I'm Jordan Crook.
And we are joined once again by John Schieber. Welcome back, John.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Sup?
You know, just chilling in LA.
For a little while longer, you're about to get on a flight.
I am about to get on a flight. Aren't we all Brazil bound?
We are.
Amazing. Yes, but Jordan and I aren't leaving for several days.
My trip is so quick. I land Tuesday morning and leave Thursday night.
That's insane.
I'm amped about it, though. It's a perfect little 96-hour sleep fest.
For folks who don't understand what it is that we're talking about, I'm assuming we're broadcasting this podcast now. We do these events all over the world now to promote technology startups and entrepreneurs that are coming from emerging tech ecosystems in places like Lagos in Nigeria, in Nairobi in Kenya. We're going to Sao Paulo for a Latin American event, and we were in Beirut earlier this year for an event there.
This is true.
Right?
And yes, and the other great thing about the event is that it gives me, at least, a lot of time to watch Netflix on the flights. So last time we, for the Beirut event, I used that copious amount of flight time to watch the first season of The Crown, which we discussed in an episode. And I think the plan is for next week, I'm going to be catching up on House of Cards, which has a new final season, which we will review next week. But this week, we're going to be reviewing The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, which is another Netflix series. It's kind of a spin-off of Riverdale. Before we get too deep into that, though, we're just going to touch really briefly on some streaming news. The first piece of news is about this. It gets a little inside baseball, but I think actually speaks to some of these broader trends in terms of the theatrical business model, which is that Netflix, for the longest time, it would release its movies in theaters, but it always insisted that they would be released on Netflix and in theaters on the same day, which meant that most movie theaters were like, fuck that, we're not going to try to, you know, compete with something that some people can watch for free on Netflix. And that's meant that basically every Netflix original movie has, you know, been in a handful of theaters when it comes out, but, you know, hasn't really been in many. And that is slowly starting to change. Netflix announced a couple days ago that Roma and The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is the new Coen Brothers movie, and this movie called Bird Box are all going to be in theaters a couple of weeks before they're released on Netflix. These aren't like enormous releases. They're not like going to be in every single multiplex. Like Roma is going to be in New York, LA, and Mexico, I think, initially. But it actually means that you're going to get to see some of these movies on the big screen. Like, I in particular am really excited about seeing Roma on the big screen. It premiered at some of the festivals this year, and everyone says it might be one of, like, maybe the best movie of the year, and a movie that you should absolutely see on a big screen. So I'm glad that Netflix is starting to loosen up a little bit.
How much of this is due to the need to Oscar bait all of this stuff, right? I mean, like, how much of this is just about the industry itself being able to reward good performances with the, like, accolades and statuettes and everything else that come along with winning an Oscar and potentially boosting distribution, all the rest of it?
I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with Oscars, yeah. I do think that a lot of the assumption, Netflix didn't openly say, oh, we're doing this because of awards, but certainly one area where Amazon has done a little better than Netflix is that they've had movies that are up for the major Oscars. Netflix has won, like, Best Documentary, but in general, the movies haven't been nominated for Best Picture, for Best Actor or Actress. Amazon has had a few nominations, and I think one of the assumptions is that that's because of the theatrical release. It's hard to say because, I think a lot of Academy members and Oscar voters just watch the movies at home anyway on, like, you know, screeners. But I think there's also this prestige thing of just, if you're a major director, if you're Alfonso Cuarón, then there's, you know, you just want your movies to be seen in theaters. And, like, these, if you make [S2] Right. [S1] A big prestige picture, you expect it to be seen in theaters. So there's something about, I don't know, like, just some, and also just something about the way Netflix kind of just, with a lot of these movies, just kind of puts them out there, doesn't necessarily promote them a lot. that I think, I don't know that just putting them in theaters on its own is what's going to get some of these movies nominated for Oscars, but I think it's part of a way of saying we take this movie seriously, we treat this as a prestige release, Oscar voters, please take this seriously too.
Yeah, I think, like, you also have to remember there was the report a while back that Amazon is reportedly going to go for a Landmark Theaters, right, and try to buy that. So, like,
which is an industry, it seems like it's still TBD what's going to happen there.
Right, like, essentially, like, this whole theater industry, like, going to see movies at the theater is in this weird state of flux right now. And I think, given that state of flux, Amazon is, or Netflix is like, we just might as well capitalize. You know, like, we might as well get involved because it's changing. We might as well be a part of it in some way. So, like, as opposed to just locking yourself down and not experimenting with it, you have Amazon doing well with their Oscar nom movies with limited and exclusive or not limited exclusive releases in theaters, and I think Netflix is just saying, like, okay, Amazon's going to try to maybe buy a theater, we, you know, could promote our movies better. And at the end of the day, still, no matter like what's happening with the theater industry and MoviePass and all that stuff, you still have there's simply just more talk around movies launching in theaters than there are movies on Netflix. Do you know what I mean? It's just the math of it. There's going to be more buzz and more kind of organic sharing and promotion of this.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an entire like industry that's been built up around distribution and promotion of movies in theaters, right? Like, it's a $1 billion industry. The thing that I think a lot of, or that I've heard, you know, being out here, is that some creative people worry that Netflix is, you know, flooding the zone with too much stuff, and that, you know, you can sign on and get paid to get your movie made or show done with Netflix, but there's no guarantee that they'll be pushing it for an audience, right? Or promoting it at all. And I think, like, with this, it's sort of an acknowledgement that they need to be playing the game on some level. To continue to attract people. I mean, throwing shit tons of money at people is obviously a great way to get them to work with you, but ultimately these people want to see their movies. They want people to see their production, right? Their movies.
Yeah, so yeah.
One other thing in the news today that I thought was interesting was a story from our very own Sarah Perez about how streaming services are just crushing it right now. Up 212%. Yeah, over 200%, which is crazy.
So on the one hand, you have, like, this isn't that shocking because, like, we are all kind of just, like, I wouldn't be surprised if those numbers were even higher next year. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think this is, like, super shocking because we all felt this shift underway for many years, but that's still kind of an outrageous number. Even if it's not shocking. Do you know what I mean? Like, it could go both ways. Yeah, and, like, I think what's happening, too, is that the kind of price increase from the cable companies, like, if you think about what's interesting about it, and I don't know if this is anecdotal. I'm not, like, this isn't based on science or actual data or anything. It's just my kind of take on it, my insight. Well, because, like, my mom and then a couple other people who are, like, my mom's age, I know, have recently switched to either, like, YouTube Now or YouTube Live or whatever it is, or Hulu with Live. And, that, like, all of them said the same thing, which was, you know, cable is just so expensive. Like, it's so expensive now. And, like, when you're that age, like, think about the price of your cable just going up and up and up forever. Like, eventually you just, like, hit the end of the rope. So this group, I think, again, anecdotally, that, like, normally wouldn't be early adopters in something technology driven have just been so pissed off at all of these cable providers for so long that they're like, whatever, let's just do it.
Well, I think that also is one of the data points in this report that Sarah was writing about, which is about how apparently live TV content turns out to be one of the big draws. And so that's been seeing, like, a 49% increase in plays, a 54% increase in viewing time. NFL in particular is, like, seeing viewing hours going up 83%. So it's also just the fact that, you know, it's just in the last recent, like basically in the last year and a half, last 2 years, that the live TV experience can now be, you know, paid for and experienced over streaming. So it's also seeing like the lines kind of getting blurred of like what it, you know, it used to be. Well, there are certain things I would get on live TV, and then I would also watch, you know, on demand stuff on Netflix or HBO Go or whatever. But now it's I mean, there's still a meaningful distinction from a business perspective, but I think for a lot of people, it's just kind of like, all right, well, if this is just the cheaper bill, it's not necessarily going to be that different to me.
I mean, I think what's interesting to me is more like what this means down the road. So, you know, as people start turning to these streaming services more and more, like what happens to the network platform like ABC, Fox, NBC, CBS, et cetera, et cetera? Do they just become sort of content production studios and move the advertising that was sort of between like interstitial ads, do they move that into product placements completely inside programming, or do they have like sponsored content in a way where you get brands vying for ad space in the far corners of like your This Is Us show or whatever?
Well, I honestly have been waiting for a long time for like the Twitter merger or purchase from like one of these TV companies, like one of these broadcast networks or something, because it just seems like, I mean, the broadcast networks don't have enough money for it, but the ISPs do. And that kind of like user generated content advertising data platform that can go alongside television to do like promotions and sponsored stuff, like as a kind of dashboard or like base level, just seems to make more sense as like as people start skipping ads and all of that stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like you got to rethink the idea of what an advertisement is to some extent, and that could make the content a lot shittier, no doubt. Yeah. But you know, it can also be done really well. I think like 30 Rock is a great example. That wouldn't work in something like House of Cards, right? Where like you don't want to be pulled out. But I've been waiting for that kind of thing. But I don't know. I don't honestly know what like a la carte or what the redivision, because it really isn't going to be a la carte. It isn't really going to properly fragment. It's just going to reassociate, like regather in new puddles under big umbrellas. That's a lot of mixed metaphors, but I made myself pretty clear.
I do think it's also one of the things, I mean, no one knows, right? And that's certainly, but there is this, I think what all the networks are scared of is the idea that they're basically just going to become, you know, content producers for Netflix and a handful of other companies. And that's why all these different companies now are trying to launch their own streaming services. And there's an element of like, Jesus, like, why do we need another service focused on whatever? But there's also an element of like, well, you got to try. Like, you can't just give up and
roll over.
And just let kind of Netflix really control the future of your business. I mean, there's probably some parallels to kind of like, I think a lot of people think like the news industry kind of screwed itself over by being so cooperative with Facebook. That's sort of a separate argument. But like, I do think there's some parallels in this idea of like how much you control your own fate and how much you can say, well, it's an uphill battle, but you can't just, like you said, roll over and give up. But it does mean that I think it's going to be a kind of a rough period for consumers because, you know, instead of like, there was a period where it really felt like you could find almost anything you wanted, certainly any show you wanted in Netflix. And right. Now you need to like subscribe to like four or five services to see like the same number of shows. But I mean, I think that's probably a better environment for, you know, for the creative industry.
Yeah. Well, and overall too, for the industry, and also like at the very least, if I canceled my cable and kept all my other streaming services, I'd still like my routine wouldn't change much. And I would save like $60 a month. So it's not like it's like gotten to the point where as long as prices stay competitive and down, like I think overall people will win, but.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I pay now for what I have Amazon Prime. I pay for Hulu and I pay for Netflix. And I have the HBO attachment for Hulu because I'm not going to miss my Game of Thrones. Or my Game of Thrones prequel, now starring Naomi Watts.
Did you guys see the season, what is it, season 8? Season 8 cover?
I did see that, yeah.
Entertainment Weekly. I like found myself Googling the news around that and reading like 8 different stories that were all like, we still don't know much. This is the picture, though. And I was like, I got to read another story. Maybe there's another tidbit. And there like never was. It was just me looking at that picture over and over again.
Well, I mean, like in between breaking news for TechCrunch or trying to follow news for TC, I took a break and read, sadly, I will out myself as having read that Entertainment Weekly piece. And apparently there's a new set. That's all I've gotten so far. There's a brand new set that no one has seen before. That
I read that too.
Yeah, it seems like the main message is just, hey, it's still coming. Hang on. And also, like, they spent a ton of money and a ton of time making this final season, which, you know, of course they did.
It was like $15 million per episode or something.
I don't think they said the number that I saw, but
yeah,
they did. Okay,
and it was like outrageous, and like originally they were promised like a much smaller number or something, like $1 million per episode or something.
Well, they started with like somewhere around that, and then it has ballooned. Right. Like the one interesting thing, getting back to this whole navigation of streaming versus distribution in movie theaters. They initially thought that they were going to do the last season as like 3 2-hour movies that they would be distributing Lord of the Rings style. Yeah.
Because they thought that was the only way they could make enough money to do it justice, like the ending that they were going to do. The only way they could get enough money was to like fundraise for three films. FOR. That's confusing. But yeah, I thought the whole thing. And then HBO eventually was like, don't worry.
We got you.
We'll pay the bill. Like, whatever. Just keep making the show.
But it's interesting. And that sort of also segues into, if you don't mind, into the sort of relationship between network television, streaming services that we were talking about earlier, and this whole Sabrina, Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and its relationship to Riverdale and everything that's going on between sort of the CW show, the Netflix show, and these sort of shared universes that keep cropping up. Right? Or was that a terrible
That's great.
Segue?
It's good. for this podcast, that was a solid transition.
We're not good at that.
The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina on Netflix. It is kind of loosely tied to Riverdale. There's not, at least I've only seen the first couple of episodes, but as far as I know, there's not like aggressive crossover, but there is enough to, there's a sense that they sort of occupy the same fictional universe. I don't really think you need to have seen one to watch the other or vice versa, right?
No. I mean, I think that there are some like references and allusions peppered through all of the series about Riverdale existing in addition to the town of Glendale, I think, which is where this takes place. So
wait, hold on. Can we go over this one more time? Mostly because I wasn't listening, but also because I'm confused about this, because you said it twice that this is based on or a spinoff of Riverdale, but is this not Sabrina the Teenage Witch?
Right, so Sabrina and Archie are both, or Sabrina and Riverdale are both based on Archie Comics characters. Obviously, the more famous ones being Archie and whatever, but that's actually where Sabrina comes from originally too. Obviously, I think most people of our age we think of her from the Melissa Joan Hart show, but yes, they're actually based. It's all from like Archie Comics, and that's why. And so this and Riverdale, basically the guy who's sort of in charge of Archie Comics, he's the showrunner of both shows, and they sort of have a very kind of similar tone.
Yes, okay, good, because we have like the same characters and names and
but yeah, stuff, it's Sabrina the Teenage Witch, and then actually,
and I never saw Riverdale.
Yeah, I mean it's if you've seen. I mean, the way I've been explaining Chilling Adventures of Sabrina to people who've seen Riverdale is like, yeah, if you just imagine sort of the Riverdale treatment, being given to Sabrina the Teenage Witch. You'll be sort of halfway there. But it is, I mean, it also is the same, like you said, the same characters as the TV show from the 90s. Although they had this video that I think Netflix created as a promotional video where the old cast members watch the new show, and I think they're trying to illustrate that, like, this is a very, very different show from the old sitcom.
Oh, definitely. Definitely different show. I agree. But, like, with the same character. So, like, the reason that I'm making a big deal out of it is because I did watch a lot, I feel like, of Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Not in, like, it's 8 o'clock on a Wednesday, I need to watch Sabrina, but, like, it was on. You know, it was on all the time, I feel like.
It felt like comfort viewing.
Yeah, like, it was on constantly. It was, like, that. There was, like, periods where there was, like, one show that was on all the time. It was, like, Family Matters was one of them that was on just all the time. Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Those are the two, really. No, I'm just kidding. There were definitely more. But, but, like, I don't know. I just, the first time that this new Sabrina says Harvey, I couldn't have remembered that guy ever in a million years. But for some reason, when she said Harvey and she was a little Sabrina witch, I was like, I just saw that dude's face for the first time in my head in like 10 years. The guy who played Harvey in the original one. And I was just like, holy shit. It was such a weird, weird memory moment. But anyway, what do you guys think of the show?
John, why don't you kick us off?
Well, I was really excited about this initially because I miss Buffy the Vampire Slayer, like, whoa. And I was hoping that this would be in the same vein, you know, have the nice sort of allegorical or allusions to sort of high school as a time when all of these things are happening to you and transformations are occurring and it's all kind of spooky and magical and weird, and it you know, the supernatural works really well as a sort of allegory for maturing and growing up. And, like, you talk about, like, seeing that Harvey's face, the sitcom Harvey when she mentions Harvey. And one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting about the show is the way that it does deal with, like, history repeating. That might be too lit class for us to start off with. On a basic level, like, you know, it's popcorn entertainment and it's fairly good. There are some weird, weird tonal choices that they make with the storyline. And there's been a lot of blowback actually around the treatment of minority characters and right. The way that they are portrayed in the show. I think some of that gets a little, if not ironed out, swept under the rug in later episodes. And I mean, I don't know if the writers were either willfully ignorant or just, you know, wildly tone deaf to some of the things that they were doing. But we can maybe touch on that later. Overall, I thought it was like a nice spooky Halloween weekend watch, and I enjoyed it for what it's worth.
It's worth so much.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed what I've seen so far. I'm not completely won over, and I have to admit, I'm a little surprised because Riverdale was a show that, like, I mean, I think we haven't talked as much about this on the podcast, which is kind of crazy because I feel like we've talked about so many things on this podcast. But that, like, I love, like, really soapy kinds of shows. Like, I mean, Gossip Girl. Like, I watched the entire first season of Gossip Girl in one night. I was, like, really, really tired the next day. But, like, that's, you know, I have a soft spot for that kind of, like, high school soap opera kind of thing.
I totally do, too. Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, and I think Riverdale actually, especially the first couple of episodes, really hit that sweet spot where at first I thought, man, like, the idea of doing this sort of quote-unquote, like, dark version of Riverdale sounds, like, really stupid and really unnecessary. But when I saw it, I was like, oh, like, this is, like, I mean, it's not, you know, totally over the top. This is still a show that, like, teenagers can watch and enjoy. I mean, I think that's true of Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, too. It's a show that takes the horror side more seriously and genuinely tries to be scary in some moments. But it's not, like, over the top with, like, either the sex or the gore or anything like that. But it didn't quite work as well for me as Riverdale did. I think partly because the supporting cast doesn't feel, I guess particularly the supporting high school cast doesn't feel as strong to me. They just really haven't kind of emerged as distinct characters. I think certainly Aunt Zelda and Aunt Hilda are good. This cousin character, Ambrose, who I don't remember from the series before, but I think he's like really interesting. Kiernan Shipka as Sabrina is fine, but like once you get into like especially like Harvey, I just find him to be a complete blank, and he's not interesting to me at all. Yeah. Like most of our high school friends, and partly because these first couple of episodes I think really revolve around this idea that Sabrina's torn between her, you know, witch identity and her human identity, but everything that you see of her human identity does not seem that compelling.
That compelling. Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to feel that dilemma as sharply.
Yes. I think that, so one thing that really bothered me and I feel like took me out of enjoying the show like frequently was the way that the camera is and shooting, like whatever the focus issue is. You know what I'm talking about?
Right. Like, it does this thing where you're in, where there's a couple of figures who are in focus, but everything else is sort of like you're seeing it through this haze.
Yeah.
It's the, I can't remember the name of the show now. The Handmaid's Tale effect, right? Where everything, like there are two characters that are in sharp focus and then everything else is fuzzy. They do that on Handmaid's Tale.
That's
all
incredibly
the time.
Disrespectful to Handmaid's Tale, in my opinion. Like you just really like dragged Handmaid's Tale.
No, but
I'm saying that
everyone is doing that shot now, and it's because of the Handmaid's Tale. Like everyone.
Yes, but maybe that idea of like messing around with the focus a little bit, but this feels very heavy-handed. Like,
oh no,
yeah,
for sure,
aggressive.
I'm not saying it's done well.
Yeah, and it's done like 100% too much. Like they need to like use that one time per episode, maybe. Like, because there was a certain situation where she was in the. This is the first episode, like very early in the first episode. So if you're upset about spoilers for the early first episode, you'd need to just leave. But, she's in the forest with Harvey and she's like talking to him about where she was born and like that she's a, you know, witch or whatever. And it made sense there because it felt like a little bit of like a force field almost, like magic had gone down. So they were in like magic space kind of. But yeah, like then I realized it would happen every 8 seconds and it started really annoying me. So that actually was like a big problem for me. I think the little actress who plays Sabrina is delightful. She's really funny. The writing is pretty funny, you know. I think it's good enough, but yeah, I don't like care about this show at all. You know, like it's fine, and I hope people enjoy it because I think it is enjoyable. And I think if you like can fall into this kind of TV show, like I don't think of this as anything even remotely similar to Gossip Girl or like proper teen dramas like Dawson's Creek and One Tree Hill and the OC. Like this is like got the spooky quality to it.
I
don't know.
I was hoping for more along the lines of like quality Buffy the Vampire Slayer, I have to say, and it disappointed on that level. It
didn't deliver.
It did not deliver. But it deals with some of the same themes. You know, I think they're trying to tackle issues of feminism and dealing with what it's like to try and figure out who you are in high school. And some of the same sort of thematic elements in the way that horror works to really amplify those struggles in a way that can make them, I guess, more interesting for folks who don't want to see my so-called life. It's not nearly as well executed. I think sometimes it waffles between being like wanting to be an incredibly scary show or a scary show, and then being the teen melodrama, and it it just sort of doesn't mediate those two tones incredibly well. But again, it's a fine show.
Yeah, it's, I mean, because you can do both. And I mean, I think Buffy is a good example of that. I mean, I should say, so Buffy for the longest time was my favorite television show of all time. I think now when I go back to it, I can sort of see the flaws a little bit more clearly. And so I don't necessarily, I think there was a period where I would, anytime anyone compared anything to Buffy, I'd be like, fight me because you are wrong. Like, Buffy is better. When, especially with like all the other like WB shows at the time where people would be like, oh, like Charmed is like Buffy. Dawson's Creek is like Buffy. You know, this is like, I was like, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. Like, Buffy is much better. And now I'm like, well, I think it was probably better, but not the order of magnitude better that it was in my head. And I do, but I think there's that is a good point that because people saw that you could combine sort of like serious and more comedic tones, not to say that Buffy is the only show or the first show that did this, but I think it did it particularly well and sort of was particularly known for this. You know, I think something like Sabrina shows like how hard it can be to go back and forth between the two, because I think definitely the funnier stuff doesn't really register with me. And when like the show tries to get more goth and not even necessarily scary, but like just kind of over the top and like genuinely like lean into the fact that like, oh, like these are witches and warlocks and they like sign contracts and blood, like that part of the show I find a lot more interesting than the sort of more tongue-in-cheek aspects of it.
Yeah, I think the discussion, like there is at some point like a discussion of free will and this notion of what is like Satanism as a religion and how it doesn't sort of deviate that much from like other religions that are controlling, or theologies where you know there's no sort of interaction between or questioning allowed between the people who are faithful and their faith, which may be again like a little too heady for a conversation about a show about a teenage witch, but it does try at least to go there, and I think that in and of itself is sort of interesting. I mentioned the tone deafness, and there is a lot of that.
How much of it Sabrina, have you seen?
I've seen the whole damn thing.
Oh, you have? Okay, so, great.
Yeah. I mean, there is the tone deafness of how do you think I spent my Halloween weekend? I have no life. That's the answer to that question. Yeah, I mean, like Sabrina is pit against another witch who is African American. They're sort of seen as similar characters. The other witch is an orphan, just like Sabrina is. She's a firm believer in all of the witch stuff, and Sabrina isn't. And there are some issues around like hazing. There's one scene in particular where this witch and her two half sisters, also orphans, are hung by Sabrina as sort of revenge for them trying to hang Sabrina herself. It's sort of replaying what was done to witches in the town of Glendale in the past. But that scene is pretty tone deaf, right? I mean, like having someone, an African American, being hung in 2018 is not necessarily, you know, an image that you need or that should resonate beyond being out of touch and not the best idea. They try to do justice by all of the characters eventually. And like you mentioned that the high school characters aren't that interesting. Over the period of the show, and this is not a spoiler, but over a period of the show, sort of the mythology of the witches in the town and the humans in the town, their relationship becomes a little bit more entwined in sort of interesting ways. And each of the, because, you know, it can't be a good teen drama without some deus ex machina, there's a lot of like interaction between all of the families in the past that comes to light that sort of complicates things.
I'm not far enough in to get into all that. I watched like an episode and a half. But it sounds, you made it sound slightly more interesting than it was before you started talking, so that's something.
Well, yeah, I think it is an interesting show, and I think like some of the things that they're attempting to do with it make it worth sort of sticking through. I mean, there are points where I was like, oh Jesus, come on, seriously. But you know, as a way to spend a few hours, there are worse things to watch on a plane. That's not
although we should say, I mean, when you say a few, it's 10 hours. It's 10 episodes, right. And each of them is like is a full hour long, because again, it's a Netflix show, and no Netflix show except for Maniac can do short episodes. So but I guess what I'm curious about is in terms of like the dynamics of how it plays out, or what's people seem to be saying about the racial dynamics of the show is that there's this, that I think there's a lot of shows now, right, want to be more diverse. They want to be more multicultural. And that's a good thing. I mean, I think that is definitely a good thing, that is progress, but it also has its limitations in the sense that sometimes they're not really grappling with how these characters of color, at least in this case, are being portrayed on screen. And so you end up with these, you know, they haven't really thought through exactly what they're showing you. Is that, well, was that I mean, your sense?
I mean, that's part of it. Also, like, I think you run into any problems where the framing mechanism is around sort of a white hero, main character, and you've got a bunch of sidekicks of like different ethnicities and races or sort of adversaries, right? The show makes some choices around making both Sabrina's family, her cousins and uncles and whatever else, diverse. And then also like the school also has a pretty diverse set. Both schools have a pretty diverse set of students in the student body, but they're all sort of supporting characters to Sabrina, right? So there's only so many narrative choices that you can make that where you're not going to step into some sort of pitfall.
Do you think it would have been a more interesting show if they decided to make Sabrina a woman of color?
I mean, yeah. So one of the things that I was reading some of the criticism online about it before we got on the line, on the call, and one of the things that people are talking about is sort of how women of color, sort of when people think of witches or good witches, they think of like Glenda the Good Witch or whatever. And then when witches are being used as negative stereotypes, sometimes they're African American or women of color. That was one thing. I mean, like, there are also some allusions to the Salem witch trials in the original, sort of woman who was accused was, I think, an African American woman that started the whole Salem witch trial business. It was someone's slave, I think, and like that, the interaction between sort of native, like not between African religions that were practiced and slavery and white genocide and all of those things, I think are interesting issues to explore historically and would be interesting to explore and talk about in the context of pop culture. But it's it's really hard to do. Did that just get weird?
I don't have any deep thoughts about this either, because I'm only two episodes in and I am still at the stage of like, hey, like, some of these characters aren't white. That's nice. Some of these characters are like non-gender binary. That's nice. Like, but beyond that, yeah. I haven't really sort of thought, seen enough to have an opinion myself. I guess one last thing that you did want to touch on, right, is we talked about The Haunting of Hill House last week, but it sounds like, John, you also watched it and saw some parallels between the shows, which, I mean, obviously there's kind of a Halloween-y vibe, but otherwise I would not have thought to compare them.
Right. Well, I mean, like, they do both. They're both wrestling with sort of personal history, family history, and the ways that those things play out and echo over time, right? I mean, to the extent that Sabrina expands its world to take in sort of the high schoolers and their families in the town. They do try to delve into a little bit of the history of sort of misogyny and how the witch trials were a response to fear of the unknown, but also I think fear of women's roles in a particular society. I'm getting way deep in the weeds on this, but yeah, that is in there. And I think with Haunting of Hill House as well, not to the same degree. I mean, I've only seen a few episodes, but it seems like it's very much about this family's personal history and the ways in which those things create their own horrors, right? That sort of echo.
Right. I mean, I think the difference is, to me, like, Hill House, I think, is definitely a show that has problems, especially I think the final episode, which I hadn't seen when we did our review, but now I've seen it, and I think is kind of a mess in a lot of ways. But despite that, I think Haunting of Hill House is, it seems like it's really like trying to face up to some of these questions of like how fucked up your parents can make you and how fucked up childhood trauma can make you. And I think right. What a show like Sabrina is doing, I think it's addressing some of the same things, but it's really through this sort of like chosen one narrative, right? It's kind of like Harry Potter or something like that, where it's the idea of like your parents were special, therefore you are special. And there's some other parental stuff that maybe comes with the other characters, but particularly if we're talking about the character of Sabrina, like it's dramatically interesting, but to me it's not like emotionally resonant at all. It's just kind of like, oh, I see. She's like, you know, another chosen one, you know, the head of like all the warlocks. It has to like come and try to convince her to become a witch just because, and you know, the devil, him or herself, is like particularly interested in her. That stuff is like fun, but it doesn't speak to me emotionally.
Well, I mean, yeah, this gets into one of the things that I think new writers in sci-fi and horror are both trying to move away from or problematize, right? Like, and it's a hard thing to do because those tropes are so ingrained in like the hero's journey and all of the stories. But if you look at like the backlash to the Star Wars movie, the latest Star Wars movie, like one of the problems is that they move away from this notion that special people are inherently special because their parents are special or were imbued with certain powers, right? Like Rey's parents were nobodies as far as we know. And that was an interesting narrative choice. And I wish that
some people are so mad about it.
But yeah, I mean, those narrative choices are more interesting in some ways. And I think it'd be great if writers would look to problematize their source material a little bit, or play with their source material a little bit more than just like re-envisioning a genre and like plopping something that was meant to be a sitcom or was seen as sort of light and frivolous into a really dark setting, whether it's Riverdale or Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. Those are both like essentially light pop culture fare that people have turned into teen Twin Peaks, you know?
Right. And it's still, I mean, there's still guilty pleasures. I think they're, you know, there's more, you know, violent and over the top stuff and sexual stuff that happens, but they're still fundamentally soap operas. And I think particularly Riverdale is very good at that. Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, we'll see. But like, I mean, yeah, the just because you sort of like amp up the sex and violence and shoot, you know, more at nighttime, that doesn't actually make it like a particularly more like serious show.
Yeah. But I mean, that said, like, Jordan, you've been really quiet. What's going on? Do you have nothing to say?
I'm here. I'm just listening. I mean,
did I just go down the nerd rabbit hole?
Did we convince you
so deep
to watch more of the show?
No. I'm not gonna do that. I'm probably not gonna watch any more of either of these shows.
Sabrina,
I would say watch Haunting of Hill House before you watch the rest of Sabrina. I think Haunting of Hill House is genuinely one of my favorite things that Netflix has done, despite my reservations.
Okay, so Haunting of Hill House actually has a chance. I'll be real with you, because like even after we recorded, normally what will happen is we'll record a podcast. I'll have watched 1 to 3 episodes. If it's something I don't want to watch, if it's my choice, then obviously I watched all of it.
Right, or vice versa. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then we talk about it, and then in the end, Anthony's like, "Are you gonna watch any more of it?" And I'm like, "Oh, maybe. I don't know. Probably not, but maybe." And I almost never do, like literally never do. But I actually watched like another episode of Haunting of Hill House after we had recorded. So that's like the most promising thing in terms of me watching these shows that's happened throughout the podcast's history. So
look at that.
In ages.
Right.
But yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's like it's all about, you know, mood. And it's pretty rare that I want like to be scared. You know what I right. mean? Like that's just not a like something I get a lot.
Yeah.
Like if I want to be really scared, I'll watch like a documentary about like modern politics.
Well, that's the thing is I want to be scared in this way that like, you know, feels like it's fun and scary and that I'll actually right. like jump up and down and like scream and stuff, but like but that doesn't feel like too close to home, you know, like it right. that it like maybe isn't like has some resonance but like doesn't actually make me think, what if I go to bed and somebody breaks into my house and murders me, you know?
Or well, just also, gives you a feeling of existential dread about the fate of humanity in the world and makes you wonder if we're backsliding also, into yeah. an authoritarian like nightmare hellscape of a political regime.
Yeah, see that like moves me. Like this kind of stuff doesn't actually like what I watched so far of Haunting of Hill House, I can see how it is like meant to be scary and it definitely is like creepy, like gives me like a little bit of a feeling of like, no, I don't want to watch a bug crawl out of a dead kitten's mouth. Like that's not what I'm vibing right now. I get uneasy, but like nothing is actually like doesn't give me like the rush, the like adrenaline rush that people talk about when they watch like horror movies and stuff. Like I just don't really experience that a lot. Not that I'm so tough or anything. It's just like, it's a movie, you know? Like, I guess like there every once in a while you like jump out of your seat because something like will be thrown at the camera, essentially. But
yeah, that's fair. I mean, I think they're definitely they're an acquired taste. And there's also like, I think lots of different kinds of horror and they're
yeah.
more slow kind of dread horror. There's others that are more about jump scares. I will also, last thing about Haunting of Hill House, I will say that in one of the last episodes, in episode 8, there is a jump scare.
Are you going to spoil it?
No, I'm not going to spoil it. I'm just going to say that it has one of the best jump scares I've ever seen. And I literally screamed, "Oh, fuck!" And there were people in the room with me. But, I was reading like a recap of it in Vulture and the author of the an article about how scary is Haunting of Hill House really, and she described her reaction to that jump scare where she was in a library and she screamed and slammed her laptop shut. So anyway, people should watch for that.
I'm down. I'm excited about that. Yeah, I look, I'm the only one who watched it all the way through already, and I will say that I did it for a reason. I wanted to see it and it was enjoyable. I'm like still jonesing for that Buffy reboot. That's really where things come down to for me. And I will, because I'm a sucker, well, not so much of a sucker, but I will consume things that are in that vein all the time, right? Like I am definitely the target audience for that. I even watched more episodes of like that crappy vampire CW show than anyone should have had any right to. What is that show called?
The spinoff was called The Originals. I'm trying to. Oh, Vampire Diaries.
Yeah, yeah. I watched far more episodes of that than I should have, and I enjoyed them. And if there's any corollary, I think the closest corollary between Chilling Adventures of Sabrina and whatever else has been on TV, it's probably that Vampire Diaries. Anyway, there we go.
Sounds good. If it is your kind of thing, you should check it out. And as always, I will just close with a brief reminder that if you enjoy the show and you don't do this already, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or the podcast app of your choice. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It would really help us get new listeners.
All right. And I'll see y'all in Brazil.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.